Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is August 4th, 2004. Today's session number is KRK-2004-03. Today's speaker is Kevin Kraus. The lesson for today is Human Genetics, Human Stem Cell Research. Let's listen in.
We should probably get started. In fact, they'll say, start the tape. They told me to say that every time. I'm not sure exactly what happens then. Somebody starts the tape. Yeah. My name is Kevin Kraus. I teach biology at Luther College. And this week I've been talking with people about issues of human genetics and the medical advances that we've made in the last 10 years and are looking forward to in the next 10 or 20 years, and talking about some of the ethical issues that come along with those rapid advances. So I'll talk for a little bit here, give you some background. This morning, the topic is stem cell research, which has been in the news a great deal in the last couple of years. So I'll talk about that for a little bit, and then we'll talk together and hear your ideas and your worries or issues that you have or questions that you might have. And, I'm here, but there's also some folks here that are experts in the medical area, and they may have better answers than I do. So when we talk about stem cell research, it's fairly complicated. I want to move back a little ways and give you some background here. So you probably realize, sitting there, that your body consists of many different cell types, we refer to them. So you have skin cells, whose job it is to create a protective layer on the outside of our bodies. Some of those skin cells produce hairs, which may be a little bit protective, but not a whole lot. But maybe a little bit help us with temperature regulation. And have some sensory capabilities too, help us with touch and feel. You have liver cells in your body creating an organ whose job, well, many jobs, one of which is to detoxify materials that come into the body. So a very different role than epidermal cells. You have neurons in your central and peripheral nervous system whose job it is to relay information about the outside world and the inside of your body and get information together. So information-carrying cells we call neurons. You have muscle cells whose job it is to create movement, whether it be of the whole body itself or whether it be of food through the body as it goes through the gastrointestinal tract. These cells have some things in common between each other and some very distinct differences that allows them to have different shapes, different structures, and therefore different roles. And we depend upon this. One of the things that's occurred as evolution has proceeded from single-celled organisms to multi-celled organisms, such as ourselves, is this differentiation of different cell types. It's very, very important. However, if you go to the beginning of the development of a human organism, it starts, as you know, with an egg and a sperm, both of which contain real specialized structures. They're really very fascinating cells, both of them. And they each have half the chromosomes that are needed for a human organism. But they get together at fertilization, and essentially you create one big cell. One big cell. And this is how most organisms start, all multicellular organisms. And so there has to be the process of development to give rise to what we have here today sitting in these chairs, a multicellular organism with over 100 different types of cells. And this would be the subject of a whole month of lectures on development and how this occurs. But during that time, certainly there's growth. So that one cell at the human cell, you can't see it with your eye, you need to use a microscope. Cells like frog eggs, you can see those. You've probably seen them in a stream or a pond. Pretty big. And so there has to be a lot of growth to get to something like this that you can see. And there has to be division. That one cell has to divide. And in fact, that's the start of this process. So at the very beginning of this arrow here, what's going on is cell division. So that first cell divides into two cells, and then those two cells each divide at the same time to make four cells, etc. 8, 16, 32. There's no differentiation yet. All those cells are like each other. So this goes on in humans for many days, this division or creating more cells. Still very small. In fact, the embryo isn't growing at this point. So each time there's a cell division, the cells that are produced are smaller than they were before that division. Okay, so you get to a point after several days in humans, in just a day if you're a frog or a chick embryo, and that's where we've studied this most often, in organisms like frogs and chicks and fruit flies. Development isn't going on inside of fallopian tubes or a uterus, and so we can get at it. And nobody really worries about research that involves sacrificing chicken eggs or frog eggs. There's not a lot of protest out there. You can't do these experiments on humans, right? It can't happen. So we study these other organisms and then try to apply what we learn to ourselves. So many divisions to create lots of cells that are like each other. And then the process of cell types arising starts. A very important time in our lives. The very first structures that start to form are in fact structures associated with the brain and spinal cord. They start forming after just a few weeks. They're first. A little bit later on, the heart is going to form after some rudimentary vessels. The heart actually starts as a single tube that's a blood vessel, and then later some crazy curvatures happen to create this S-shaped thing, and then compartments start to form. And in fact, all the compartments aren't finished forming until just after we're born. So heart muscles, those cells start to form. We start to have rudimentary skeletal muscles after a few weeks. At some point, cells that secrete cartilage and start to make the beginnings of a skeleton start to work. All of these cells are forming different from one another because they start to express different genes than one another. So different cell types arise from different genes being used. Therefore, different proteins being made by these different cell types. When it all works out, you get a new organism with all these different cell types, each group of cells doing their job, and things go pretty well. During development, say you get to a point where you have lots of different cells that are all alike. A few of them start this process of differentiation. So this cell here might divide into two cells, one of which then starts to become like a muscle cell. It starts to produce the proteins actin and myosin. The other one doesn't differentiate yet. It can divide again a little bit later on, this one, to produce two cells, one of which then goes on to become muscle cell and the other one doesn't, and it can divide again. So this process of differentiation starts, but at the same time there remains this population of cells that don't differentiate. They have the potential to differentiate, but they also, more importantly, have the potential to produce more cells, because that's still important as the embryo is growing. This is a population then, these cells that aren't differentiating but can give rise to more cells and differentiated cells are stem cells. They're undifferentiated, but they have the potential to divide and give rise to differentiated cells. So there's lots of those cells in an embryo, because the embryo needs a pool of cells that can give rise to other cells. When you get to the adult organism, there are very few of those. We have a good population of stem cells in our bone marrow that can give rise to one or more of the different blood cell types that we have in our body. So in that bone marrow, there's a group of undifferentiated cells that when we have a wound and lose red blood cells, they can crank up and start dividing now and give rise to some red blood cells and to some more stem cells like themselves. Or you get a bacterial infection and you need to make white cells to fight that infection. Those stem cells can be triggered to start dividing. That's very important that we have that population there. In fact, even a mature red blood cell that gets made doesn't last very long, it turns out, in the body. It's a tough job being a red blood cell. You have to travel through very narrow spaces, the capillaries. You get beat up and bruised, and eventually you stop working. And so red blood cells have a very short life in our body, so we need this population of bone marrow cells. We don't have a population of cells in our body that can give rise to neurons. A very few.
They exist.
Very few.
Small.
So, you know, people talk.
Trying to figure out ways to make those babies grow.
People talk about, you know, you're only losing brain cells as an adult, and that's pretty much true. You don't have a bone marrow supply like for neurons like you do for blood cells. The same with most of our other tissues. Well, we've known about that for a long time as we've studied development and played around with things. Yes?
Nerve cells? Like, if people get paralyzed, those don't regenerate either.
Not very well. There's an expert sitting back there.
You
she can comment.
You grow your myelin. Okay, so for example, let's say that you yang on your arm, you break your arm, you damage the nerves around something called a brachial plexus. The nerves get stretched. The nerves themselves are kind of intact but stretched. They'll regrow the covering of the nerve called the myelin. And so there's people kind of talk about that, and that's where a lot of focus is to try and, like with Christopher Reeves, is you get that myelin to regrow, to get those damaged nerves to reconnect, but it's not what it, you know. If the nerve is really disconnected, you know, the myelin won't really do well. It won't matter if there's myelin there, but actually nerves connected.
Certainly, the regeneration in the central nervous system is something we really wish we could do. Other animals can do it. You can cut the arm off of a salamander, and it'll not only regrow the skeletal parts, but it'll regrow the nerves. Humans can't do that, as you know. That's why we have lots and lots of people in wheelchairs after accidents. If your spinal cord gets severed, we don't know how to... It doesn't regrow on its own, and we haven't been able to figure out how to manipulate it so that it will. It's a hope. It's a real hope, but it's years and years and years and years away.
Well, would that happen with a salamander, if you severed his spinal cord?
There can be some regrowth. Earthworms can regrow their spinal cord. People do that. They've done experiments, and the spinal cord can regrow in an earthworm. I'm not sure about a salamander in its spinal cord.
I'm trying to think of another vertebrate. I mean, you know, is there another vertebrate that can regenerate a spinal cord?
Not that I know of.
So the difference between a broken arm healing and the bone mending and a spinal column break and the nerves not regenerating is because of the stem cells in the bone marrow?
Well, we have a continuous population of cells that secrete bone, especially when we're younger. When they start to peter out as we get older and we don't regenerate or heal breaks very well. But we can reform bone. It's a secreted structure. It's different than a spinal cord, which is in fact made up of cells. Bone is secreted. It's actually more of a mineral. It's calcium phosphate. So it's a different question. Several years ago, someone took bone marrow cells out of a mouse and then human, and in petri dishes, in the lab, they showed that they could treat those cells with different hormones and chemicals and actually get those cells to differentiate into things they normally did not. In fact, into things like muscle cells and cells that looked like hepatocytes, had the same enzymes as liver cells. And this was a great finding. And I don't know exactly the year this was. It was sometime in the early 1990s. And it started people thinking, you know why we're worried about this is because sometimes we don't have all the cells we need. Not just spinal cord injuries, but we have situations in human health where we're deficient. Our livers fail, our sensory systems, our eyes, our ears very often don't work as well as they should. And gee, it'd be nice if we could get a tune-up and get some replacement parts. Right now we do organ transplants. That's been going on for 30, 40 years. We're getting better and better at those, but you know there's a problem of matching. Very often people wait and wait before there's a match that they can accept that their immune system won't destroy. And we've gone to things like suppressing our immune systems while we do transplants. So it's a question that we have about human health. So people started thinking about stem cells, and of course that led other people to say, well, you know what, embryos have the best stem cells of all. Their stem cells, it turns out, people took them and put them in dishes and treated them, have an even better capability than bone marrow cells of becoming other types. So embryonic stem cells seem to have more potential for forming different cell types than even bone marrow cells. And so, in fact, people took cells from embryos and created some cell lines. A cell line is a group of cells that you can keep in the lab in petri dishes, and in fact, you can share them with each other. They can be frozen and thawed out, and they still live, and they can be sent around the world, and labs can share them. And so people started doing these experiments. It was about that time, as you know, scientists are kind of thinking and being creative as they are and thinking about how they do this, that other people, non-scientists, heard about that and said, you know, I don't know if this is quite right, that we would be using these embryonic cells for these purposes. In fact, it's become, as you know, kind of a sociological or political issue in this country. And a couple years ago, this administration decided that no more embryonic cell lines should be made. We should stop where we're at. We could use the ones that have been made, and I forget what the number is. It's not hundreds. It's more like 10 to 20 lines exist. But we should stop now, and you can keep doing research there on those, but we got to slow down on this. And so this has led to the debate in this country and in this world about stem cell research and whether it's good or not. Yes, sir.
Well, at what stage, I mean, you know, say at the blastula stage of development of an ovum, you know, is that considered stem cells, or when are they actually considered stem cells? I don't understand.
Well, they would be stem cells at that point, but it goes later than that, but I'm not sure when that ends in a human embryo. And it would probably be that the further along you went, the less capability they would have. So the earlier you get cells, the less, the more options they have in terms of differentiation in the lab.
But it's my understanding there are still stem cells in cord blood when a child is born.
Apparently, yes.
There's stem cells everywhere.
Yeah.
But they're a pretty limited number. They're very persnickety. So you do have stem cells on the brain, at least in, you know, rodent brains, and we think human brains as well, but they're really, you know, we don't know how much they do. There's stem cells certainly in umbilical cords, but, you know, it's a small source. They're not very pluripotent, we don't think. I mean, people are looking all over because of this ethical issue, you know, of embryos, but it seems, you know, the devil's in the details in terms of making these babies grow and making, you know, and I don't mean baby, I mean, these cells. But, you know, but then that's sort of intentional because, you know, could we create a baby, you know, could we make the artificial uterus, could we women become farms for...
Well, I know there are circles in which, you know, the use of your language would not be laughed at all.
Yeah. No, but this is a, you know, but it is a little... There are stem cells there, and certainly the liquid liver's got a fair number. But again, making them do what you want them to do, what you need them to do, depends on the chemical of the hormones. Mm-hmm. And where they land, you know, where you put them, because that whole... milieu that they're surrounded by very much directs what they turn into. You know, and it's not just one cell. You know, if you put stem cells in the brain, well, you might get a whole bunch of, maybe you won't get neurons, but you'll get the 90% of cells called glia that really are connectors. They're not really, you know, they surround the neurons, but they don't really, we don't think, do anything in making you move your arm or whatever. So it's, I mean, there's a lot, it's very complicated.
I've heard of people saving umbilical cords when their child is born in case the child needs it for something.
Yes, and
later on,
it's not a standard practice yet, but people have talked about whether this should be standard practice. A baby is born, a piece of the umbilical cord is frozen and saved for use, probably best for blood cells later on in life. And of course, when we have cancer treatments that destroy the bone marrow, it's pretty traumatic. It's a big problem. We've gotten better and better at bone marrow transplants in the last 20 years, but we still have a way to go. For many cancer patients, that's the hurdle we can't get over. And so there's some of this going on, and maybe someday it'll be a standardized procedure, like all the other standardized procedures now with babies, with that, newborns. Yes?
Can you expand on how that umbilical cord would be helpful later?
There would be stem cells there.
Actually, the cord of blood.
Yeah,
not the umbilical cord.
That we could use, we're not sure about what all the potential there is yet. We believe there's great potential. But those cells could be frozen, and then as we learn more, as research goes on in the coming years, we might be able to use those cells for lots of different purposes if that person becomes deficient in some cell type later on. You know, even if we can do some of this, there are lots and lots of technical hurdles. You know, even if we could grow a pancreas in the lab, you still have to get it into people and get it to establish and make the hookups and neurons. It's hard to believe that we could bring them in and expect them to make the connections that they made. That happens during development. And I don't know, it's a head scratcher to think that would work. But we've done some amazing things in the past. So, yes, David.
Is there a direct connection between an individual and that person's stem cells, or can stem cells basically be utilized for any individual? Will they adapt to some other? I'm trying to think of why, in particular, one person's umbilical cord and not just a stack of them and borrow anybody else's.
Well, in terms of immunology, it would be the best if that came from theirs, but it'd be better than an adult transplant from another organism, because they haven't probably fully differentiated their cell surfaces. And I don't know the answer to that, you know, if they're less allergenic or reactive to somebody else.
They actually seem to work better. For example, Duke's got a cord blood depository, which is probably, if you're going to, you know, donate your child cord blood, that's the best way to do it. But you've got to be kind of there in that area to make that happen. And there's companies that can get your cord blood donated to, and it's in all the OB offices. I don't know if anybody here's had a baby recently, but, you know, they've got all the things. But
yeah, you know, there. But you can, you know, if you have a child with cancer, a kid or adult with cancer, you know, one of the things you can do is you can, you know, it's kind of like what they call HLA typing. You know, that you got to sort of be typed and matched up, and so you can be matched up to this cord blood that's been saved at a place like Duke or something. And so you still have to be matched. You can't just go in there and pull something off the shelf and think it's going to work. I mean, there's some, but they do seem to be less, I think, immunogenic than than say getting it from a non-matched sibling, for example.
You mentioned that this administration had kind of cordoned off your number of lines, and you mentioned going slow. What are those arguments? What was the argument that led to that sort of an approach?
I'm not sure what all the details are. In fact, there's a document that's been now produced by this administration, but it's been written by the science advisor, Leanne Hess, and I haven't read it. And so those arguments are there, and you can probably find that on the appropriate website. But I'm thinking that it's somewhat tied to the abortion issue, that there's some worry that if we deal routinely with embryonic tissues, that may stimulate an increase in abortion somehow. I don't quite get that one, but it seems like that's within the realm of possibility. I think other issues involve people worried that we, and this is their language, would be playing God to some extent. And they probably think we do that already in human medicine, that we try to prolong our lives longer than we should, and that we go to too dramatic a measure to prolong our lives. I think that's some of it. I don't know. Does anyone else have ideas there? Yes, sir?
Oh, I think the argument for those who don't feel that we should use stem cells at all goes quite a bit further than that. I mean, there is some fear there that that women might farm themselves out to be stem cell factories, so to speak, and you know, let those immature cell forms be harvested, you know, whenever they seem to be best fit for the purpose for which they're being harvested. So that's a whole different realm than just the abortion question, which is a big question in the political realm.
I mean, I don't think anybody could imagine before this last 30 years people being surrogate mothers in terms of fertility, and yet it's fairly routine now. We've moved up to that and through it to some extent. So I think people worry that we may change too quickly and move into areas that we shouldn't be in. Yes, ma'am?
I think also it's the, if you believe that life begins at conception, then are you taking a life? If you start to, and manipulating it and playing with it, that's probably, I think that's the big ethical base to what they're talking about with the stem cell and the embryonic research. Is that point, or does life begin when it differentiates into, or where is that point?
Yes.
I think people might start thinking that women would begin to believe that they had like an excuse for an abortion now. Oh, I'm donating it to science. It's okay that I'm getting this abortion.
Easier mentally to proceed there, yes.
I think it's also important to not get distorted and confused by what the media has told us about this administration's position. The administration's position is no federal funding for stem cell research. There's nothing that says a private industry cannot do stem cell research. Embryonic stem cell research. So what this means is, if this were a truly viable, promising technology, industries would be jumping on this the same way they jumped on the Human Genome Project. When the government was running the Human Genome Project, it was proceeding at a snail's pace. When private industry got into it, bang.
Yep.
The human genome was decoded and whatnot. If embryonic stem cell research were as promising as Ron Reagan said it were, there would be people pouring money into this technology. Adult stem cell research stuff has worked.
It's moving
somewhat.
Along. So, I mean, again, the devil's in the details with all of this making it happen. Because there's so many factors that influence, you know, harvest, making them grow. I mean, it's really difficult.
Well,
but the thing is, there is actually private money pouring into this, and there's actually some, you know, state initiatives pouring into this. I think California has, you know, there's different states that have thought about funding it on their own. So I think money is, but you know, the thing is, in order to get these human embryos, you have to get past an institutional review board of some sort or another. And you know, I think that I don't have a problem with this pausing and saying, wait, let's think about this. And in the meantime, sort of scrambling around for other sources. Yeah, but you know, I think the money is going in, but it's not just the lack of promise that's holding people back. There's some institutional safety checks, you know, that are holding things back.
Well, my understanding, and I might be wrong, I'm not an expert in this, my understanding is there has not been one incident of a successful embryonic stem cell procedure being done on humans, yet there have been successful adult stem cells harvested. And I think, Kevin, when you bring up the abortion issue, this could be the new political ploy to say that abortion, if you watch the Democratic Convention, they never mentioned abortion, but they did hit embryonic stem cell research really hard, because now it's maybe an awful lot of posturing this particular issue as a direct shot against the right to life people, rather than saying abortion is now a scientific thing.
Right.
Embryonic stem cell research. So it's sly. I mean, both sides are real sly in this thing. But I think we have to be careful not to hold out too much promise for something that there's no proof will work
at this point. True.
And either Ron Reagan is completely misguided or he's completely deceptive. Because, for example, Alzheimer's, a dad dies of Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's is never going to be treated with stem cell research because it's a whole brain disease.
I would agree with you completely.
That's ridiculous.
You know, you could probably try and guide some things towards the hippocampus, you know, because that's where the memory learning is. But no, I have real issues with him trying to tout Alzheimer's being cured by
and using his father.
Oh yeah, no, I have huge issues with that. But I completely agree with you there. I think Alzheimer's is a terrible model.
Terrible
for stem cell transplant. It's a terrible model. It's the worst you could pick.
And then to use your dead father as an example, why we should be having stem cell, embryonic stem cell research is a kind of a tough thing. But anyway, I'll shut up. Sorry.
Yeah, it's off the track somewhat when they get going there. It's easy to use Alzheimer's because there's a lot of pain and suffering with a lot of people. And so people sit up and listen. But the fact is, when the brain is going bad and making bad stuff, putting good stuff in isn't necessarily going to change that bad stuff is going on. And so it's not a simple answer, no matter what people say in the press.
Can you say some more about, are there any other regulations other than funding against stem cell research?
I wouldn't know very much in that area. As you said, that you know, each institution has review boards that review the use of human tissue. Mm-hmm. And so it's a group of both professionals and lay people, usually, mm-hmm. who discuss the experiments that are going on at that institution. Even at Luther, when an experiment's going on that's going to use a person, not just a part of a person, but it could be a psychological survey, there's a group, the Human Subjects Review Board, that has to meet and talk about it. So that's a regulation that has to happen.
But in the private sector?
In companies, there as well, I believe. I don't know the details.
Yeah, there's something called the Western IRB, the Western, you know, Internal
Institutional Review Board.
Mm-hmm. So there's stuff, it may be, you know, of course your review board can be stacked in any way that you want it mm-hmm. stacked. But there is some, I don't know that it's to the same, you know, degree, but it's pretty hard. I mean, it's really pretty hard to get, you know, although, this is in the United States, so you've got all these labs elsewhere, mm-hmm. so these rogue labs, so to speak, you know, in Italy.
The rules are not the same in every country, right?
Yeah, you know, Thailand, I mean, you know, the technology's been out here for a long time. It's not, you know, it's standardized technology now that it's not, that is easily transportable. Other countries are doing it. And so the question is, should the United States, you know, are we going to be left behind by not looking into this? And that's kind of, you know, we're now like Britain's establishing something, you know. And so that's kind of where people are, oh gosh, you know, the whole, you know, if you don't put federal money into this, we're going to be, you know, we're going to be left behind in the new space race. I don't think that it's necessarily a bad thing to be left out of.
Yeah, we kind of pride ourselves on being first in a lot of things. And it turns out that being first is not always the best. When you go quickly, or somebody told me once, when you take a big step, you're less likely to know where your foot's coming down, the bigger the step is. Yes, ma'am.
Could you say something about the success that they've had with inserting genes into cells, for example, that produce insulin? Is this completely different, or?
Well, no, it's in the same big realm of genetic manipulation. And they come together here with stem cells and gene therapy. I mean, it could be someday that we've got stem cells and we change them with genes and then put them into people. So you can bring these two together. We're very good at taking DNA out of any organism you can think of, whether it be a plant, a bacteria, or a mammal such as ourselves, and putting it into different organisms. The insulin thing, I think this is the third time I've mentioned it this week. Many years ago, we used to use, I believe it was pig insulin that we used to give to people who are diabetic. And then we were able to identify the human insulin gene and cut it out of the chromosome and put it into a bacterial chromosome. And now we grow bacteria in big vats, or some companies do. I'm not sure which companies are the leaders here. And then we've learned how to purify proteins out of complex mixtures. And we purify insulin and sell it in little bottles now to people who are diabetic. It's made their life much, much, much better to have this available. And so in the pharmaceutical industry, this is fairly common, that we make protein products, whether they be hormones or structural proteins, using bacteria and genes that have been brought into bacteria. Certainly in the agricultural industry, we've created all sorts of new plant varieties that are carrying genes from other plants or from bacteria. And you've heard of these products, corn that's Roundup ready, or BT corn that produces this bacterial protein that when caterpillars eat it, they die. Their gut gets punctured by a crystal. So we're very good at that. Again, we're moving fast there. We've had some slowdowns, but not as many maybe. Tomorrow, I'm going to talk about gene therapy, just a little bit about that. We've talked about it for a long time. We've done a little bit of it. Not a lot yet has been done. Again, like stem cell research, it's sort of in the, we need to figure out how things really work here, but we think there's a lot of potential for this. We really do.
Well, and I tell you, the gene, unfortunately, right now you have to sort of use AK-47 to get the cells, and you have to use bone marrow stem cell transplant, bone marrow transplant, which means you have to irradiate the entire body. I mean, so really right now, and I've come to this situation clinically a couple times, like, do I recommend stem cell transplant to a kid who's got a neurodegenerative disease? I can replace the enzyme by getting, hopefully, from someplace normal, stem cells derived from marrow or cohort blood, but the kid has a 50-50 chance of dying just from the process itself. And is it worth the kid, and all you're going to do is keep the kid at where they're at. And if they're already, halfway down the road to death, is it really worth maintaining them at that level for a number of years? Now, if you identify now let's say you have a sibling who's born, it's a baby, not symptomatic yet, well, maybe it's worth transplanting that child because you'll keep them, hopefully, at their pre-symptomatic state. But that's a big problem with gene therapy is the transplant itself is still really life-threatening.
Mm-hmm. We're not as good at getting DNA into human cells so that it stays there. We can put DNA temporarily in, but to have to keep putting it in every few months doesn't seem all that feasible. And so getting it into the chromosome so that it's stable and inherited by cells that are the result of cell divisions is still something we're working on. People a lot use viral vectors as in bringing DNA in because we've learned a lot about viruses in the last 30 years as we've dealt with them and studied them. So these different areas of research tend to come together now and then, and it's fascinating as a scientist, but there are lots of details. And part of the problem in these medical cases is that you, as parents with children who are sick, or parents who are sick, it's really your first time with that experience. And making these decisions about treatments and end of life are very hard. They're new to you. And yet you have medical professionals who maybe deal with it every day. And so how do you bring these people together and get decisions made in a timely way, in a way that people can feel comfortable with? It's a whole area of medicine or human treatment that we have a ways to go with as well. Big questions on people's shoulders. And maybe it's a lot to ask of the medical professionals to make those decisions. They have to bear that burden as well as the parents. So it's tricky stuff.
And I think as a clinician, I don't see people, you only see a couple of cases in your career. So you go to the places that do a lot, University of Minnesota being one of them, where they do a lot of these different transplants for genetically inherited diseases. Well, their numbers are maybe 20. Well, there's a bias on their part, particularly at Duke, not to name names, but there are,
you know, some different places, that, because these investigators need to get their app, they need to get the number of their patients up so they can publish. Mm-hmm. So you have to be a little bit careful, because sure, they want to take your patients, sure, they'll take care of figuring it out, but you know, their ulterior motive, whether they did it or not, is, yeah, I need to get my experience up so we can see if this works or not. You know, so you really have to be an advocate for your family. You know, so this idea, this pure idealist, yes, we're going to save your baby. Yeah, there is some of that, but there's some of this, yeah, I got to get promoted. Yeah, I've got to get...
I got to get my next grant.
I
got to
get my grant money. I got to
so
get...
So money, 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 money.
You know?
Is there at the root of a lot of this.
But that's why there are institutional review boards.
Precisely.
To look into that and protect the patient. I write consent forms for studies a lot in the University of Washington, and they're daunting forms. I mean, by the time I'm done with the consent form for a pharmaceutical, where I'm talking a 20-page document that has to be written at a sixth grade level for people to read and then go over, and I'm sure you're right, there are also people out there looking into that, but the institutional review board, that's their job, and a big thing is to protect the patient as well.
But how can you give informed consent when you're desperate?
Right.
Desperate people do desperate things.
But you might have to give that
consent forms are unreadable by the time you get done with them, by the time you get all the clauses in.
Yes.
Despite your best efforts and my best efforts, you know, the simplest consent form is at least 6 pages long.
You think there's any promise in maybe using embryos from another species?
There could be, yes.
Or human, you know, pigs, for example, are pretty close to us.
In many ways.
I mean, yeah. I don't mean that as a person. I said us. I didn't say you. You know, or maybe some other ape, or...
Absolutely. And, you know, the problem is we don't know enough yet. Mm-hmm. We just have to keep working at it. And I'm sure there are people who are studying this. Because, you know, and whether people agree with what this administration did or not, when it was done, when it happened, you know that there are scientists out there who said, okay, they're stopping it this way, I'm going to find another way. I'm going to look in adult tissues, I'm going to look in other species. That's what we do. I mean, scientists are very creative, and that's part of the fun in science, is finding a way around this hurdle, around this problem. And so I don't know a lot about what people are doing there with other species, but I bet people are looking. Absolutely.
Just to understand again a little bit more about the goal, like you use the example of growing a liver. I mean, is that ultimately the goal? Would you be able to actually grow an organ, a particular part, in some kind of lab situation and then insert it into a human being? Is that kind of like the, at least the current
people
goal?
Think people are thinking seriously about that sort of thing, yes. Not with all organs, but yes. It probably easier to understand how more a loose tissue as opposed to an organ might be grown, but people are thinking about that, yes.
For an organ, if you grew it outside of a body, wouldn't it grow like a lot differently?
I would think so.
For example, what you do is like, you can do islet cell transplants. Islet cells are the cells of your pancreas that make insulin. So what you could do is grow up, and then they've done this at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, just in the past 6 months. And, you know, I don't know how it's working so far, but then you inject them, and the cool thing is they somehow seem to land. I don't know where they end up landing, but they do seem to secrete insulin from wherever they're at. So, no, it doesn't have to make a pancreas. The liver, people are working a lot of places trying to make an artificial liver that you can either use temporarily on the outside while you're as a bridge, kind of like the mechanical heart bypass, you know, to get you by while you're waiting for your liver transplant. Or maybe, you know, that this liver can actually regenerate itself to some degree. If you just inject the certain cells of the liver that are the filtering cells, you know, with those, again, but, you know, where, you know, you inject them, and do they take hold, and do they stay where they're going to be, and do they turn into tumors or not 10 years from now? You know, people haven't really thought a lot about, we've all thought kind of short term, well, gosh, is it going to work and do what we want it to do? But the bigger thing is, 20 years from now, you're going to end up with something worse than what you started off with.
But you've got 20 years.
You've got 20 years.
You're doing something like that. You don't have 20 years with what you've got.
Well, that's why people are willing to study these studies. Because, you know, they're on the table and, you know, they're in the ICU and they're going to die. Unless, again, desperate people do desperate things. And sometimes, you know, people do things even when they know they're going to die because it might, you know, out of altruism, it may help someone else.
I mean, people freeze themselves, right? Or have themselves frozen after they die because who knows?
Yeah.
In 50 years, maybe we'll know how to throw people out and cure them. It seems ridiculous. But I think growing organs is much less ridiculous. They don't have to be the same shape. You know, the liver, its shape isn't all that important.
It's
it has to
cells.
Fit there. It's what the cells can do.
Isn't part of the ethical issue with stem cell research, too, though, that you might be able to manipulate creation? That you could take a cell and parents could decide, you know, I want a blue-eyed, blonde, bright boy, and manipulate. If you go way back to the extreme use of stem cells, I think that's part of the ethical debate, is where do you end? If you use it just to regenerate livers, that's one thing, but if you use it to create a human being in a certain manner, you know, then that's a whole other issue.
Right. This is at the basis of a lot of this talk and these techniques. And again, some people would refer to this as playing God.
Right.
And, you know, is that something we should be doing? Or have we crossed a boundary there?
And if you move forward without regulation, potentially people will use it to create genetically modified or people in a certain
sure.
fashion. I think that's part of the reason our government wants to make sure we're doing it in a regulated fashion. Some
it's super risky.
I mean, Adolf Hitler had some of these ideas, right? As far as we know. I haven't talked to him, but this is what we hear about some of what he thought. And we know that some of the discussion around human cloning has people saying, you know, I would like to clone myself. And I think that it would be important for someone like me to be in the world. and they're being serious. They're being serious and truthful. And so lots of different opinions about life and how it should go. I mean, if you had the chance, would you live till you were 500? I mean, if we started talking about genetic manipulation so that people could live longer, there'd be lots of people who'd sign up for that. You know, from where they're at right now, because it just seemed like it'd be better than not. So that'll come up at some point, probably not in our lifetime, but there's lots and lots of people studying aging for all kinds of good reasons, because aging isn't a lot of fun. And so we look at that, and people have been able to extend the life of rats and fruit flies and other things. And
we know it was possible in the past.
To live longer.
Methuselah?
Yeah, Methuselah and more.
I mean, it's part of human stories. Living long is a good thing.
962.
I'm curious about this freezing stuff. I really thought that was only in science fiction. People actually have themselves frozen?
Yeah. There are companies who will do that for you.
Yes.
It turns out you have to pay rent.
Can't
buy a condo.
So are there a handful of these in the world, or pots?
I don't know how many there are, but they do exist, yes.
I didn't think that freezing yourself was really all that good, because even if it was possible to thaw you out later on, most of your tissues and stuff really damaged or destroyed in the process of freezing.
Well, of course, these companies claim that they've overcome that hurdle, no one knows. You're absolutely right. It seems like there'd be a lot of tissue damage. But the people who do that, who know that there's tissue damage, hope that in 50 years we have a way of overcoming that tissue damage. Yes, David?
You know, every year at Luther, one of the things that incoming students have to do is read one book that the entire incoming class is reading. And the book for this year is Frankenstein. And it's really, you know, I've seen the movie, of course, you know, and have never read the book. But the book is very different from what's portrayed in the movie. It really addresses a lot of these issues, and it was written by actually a 17, 18-year-old girl who wrote it in the turn of the century, last year, 1800s, late 1800s. And it's interesting to see struggling with those questions about, you know, creating a human being. The process isn't described in the book. I mean, it's sort of like shows up, he's in a shop, and, you know, kind of grows this person. But it raises issues about the individual and companionship and relationship and friendship and what it turns out to look like and sort of unleashing this creature in the world who really is very different from the rest of creation and has no companionship. I mean, there's a lot of the issues that are kind of surrounding the general idea of working with human part, so to speak, and so it's a really interesting read.
Most of the book, or much of it, consists of letters written by the person to relatives, I guess you'd say, and show a lot of the angst and worry about how I fit in, how I can be part of the community. And it is very interesting.
And even the book, I didn't really see the movie, but the book, The Green Mile, with the gentleman who was touched by the inmate and then got this long, long life without any disease or whatnot, it ended up being a curse for him. I mean, I know that's fiction and it's literature and whatnot, but it's an interesting study on this relational thing where he got so old, all of his friends had died. Everybody he knew had died. His kids had died. Everyone had died. So, you know, kind of to come a little bit of a circle with the stem cell thing or any kind of research, is it a longevity issue or is it a quality of life issue? You know, do you want to make it a curative thing or a longevity thing? Or are those two things mutually inexclusive? I mean, maybe they're together.
I think we're going for cure.
At this point.
Well, the thing is, though, even stem cells in the lab, and you know, or whatever you name you want, neural precursor cells, whatever you want to call them, they don't really divide indefinitely. Even lines that you have growing, you know, after about what we call 20 passages, you know, divide them, you know, grow them up, divide them, you know, split them up, grow them up some more. They have a lifetime. You know, they don't really even live forever. I mean, they just kind of poop out after a while. It's like I do your experiments in the place and in the point where they're actively dividing before they really start to kind of. So they don't stem cells.
Does the 90-year-old with pancreatic cancer get it, or does the 40-year-old?
Whoever has the money.
Yeah, I mean, to be real honest, that's where it's at. You know, we've got, you know, right now Medicare is not covering those transplants. You know, I mean, they're just being done. But you know, think of her quality of life. You didn't have to inject yourself all the time. You could have your insulin cells, you know, in wherever they landed, hanging out doing their job.
And they'll need to be a review board to decide
who
gets the greater quality of life.
But at this point, you know, they took their most brittle diabetics. The people really have horrible complications. Mm-hmm. And you know, whenever you do these, I won't take this away. I mean, but you know, you first do the stage one studies, where you do it in the people who might not benefit one way or the other, but you just show that it can work. It's the same like with chemotherapy. So in chemotherapy, you put in the people who are end stage, you've tried everything else, they're gonna die. Stage two, you try to show that it actually works in people who it might benefit. And then step three is you try and show that a large number of people, and you're really looking for does it work for a large number of people? But, you know, and then you're looking for toxicities at step one. You know, but these are people who are, no matter what you do, you can't help.
And each institution that does transplants of any type has a committee within the institution that makes those decisions, that does decide if you're on the lung transplant list, the liver transplant list. They do decide who gets it and who doesn't, who is listed and who's not. They do make those ethical decisions, and it's, you know, based on a myriad of factors that are set up at each institution. For instance, the University of Washington, they have a strict cutoff of 65 for a lung transplant. But there are institutions around that look more at health, not a strict age issue. So it's another big ethical point within a point, you know. It's kind of.
I think it's important, and I've said this before in the other sessions, that to some extent everybody be aware of the basic facts here and the questions. Because it does come up in politics and in discussion at our churches. And so we need to be informed here and we need to be involved. So it's important to talk about these things and push people who are running for office about what they think and what they know about these things so that it can go as smoothly as possible. We'll probably make mistakes. We have in the past. But generally, we do our best with these sorts of things.
It seems, though, Kevin, with a lot of these technologies, it's really strictly market-driven. I mean, if there's, you know, a market for these technologies will be developed, and there seems to be no arena where there's evaluation for, you know, consequences or, you know, the changes and impacts it has on, you know, other quality of life kind of things. And, you know, to me that seems...
I think we have to push for those arenas. Mm-hmm. You're right. I think we would let some things go without enough discussion if left to just the market and money.
So I mean, all the alternative energy stuff that's possible, and it's, or places that, you know, going down a certain road scientifically doesn't happen because there's not a market. It's not.
Right.
Or it's blocked by other interests.
Well, that's an interesting point because, you know, there are so many things where the market is the only screen on something coming to the market or not. You know, there is virtually no, I mean, yeah, I know the federal government has this thing about stem cells that they, you know, decided not to expand the number that we currently had. But much of the genetic engineering kinds of things that have gone on have virtually no regulatory pieces in place at all. It's totally market-driven.
In terms of the choices of which projects get pushed,
Roundup Ready corn or beans or... You know.
And part of that's because it takes money to develop these things. And so, you know, there has to be investors and people who are getting paid during the years of research before a product is derived. Yes?
I watched a movie called Lorenzo's Oil in... biology class last year, and it's about this little boy who gets this pretty rare disease, I don't remember what it's called, but his parents did like everything they could and researched a ton and eventually sort of found this semi-cure for him, but it was such a rare disease and there weren't a lot of people to do the study on, and there weren't a lot of people to fund the study on it, that there was basically no cure and the parents had to like find out a cure for themselves.
Yeah, I'm actually very familiar with that disease. I had a child die of it this spring in adrenal dystrophy. And that story, you know, the Lorenzo's Oil works somewhat. They've actually tried to do that. You know, they tried to get the money to do the proper trials because everybody thinks their kid's getting better on it. But when you really do a properly randomized controlled trial, which he wants to randomize a kid to the placebo arm, there really wasn't much difference in the kids who had the active form of the disease. There's now some thought that the kids who are, the brothers, that happens in boys, that in the brothers were pre-symptomatic, there may be some role for it. But these guys, you know, but yeah, again, some of this stuff is pushed by advocacy groups. And we've had some, you know, although it's market-driven, we have had different diseases that have made further inroads because parents have really pushed, and families have really pushed, and spinal muscular atrophy is another, where now the parent groups are getting onto this. Of if they push and they can find a few labs and get it fund a few labs and get them publishing and out there, that things can happen. So you're not totally powerless. And these people made a difference, not for the old child, but I think they did make a difference for the adrenal dystrophy world.
Somebody before said something about producing the perfect child, and Mae West wrote a letter supposedly to Einstein saying, with your brains and my looks, we could have perfect children. And he wrote back and he said, with my looks and your brains, we could have an awful lot of ugly, stupid ones.
Kevin?
Yep.
In terms of the, you know, when you're looking when they're looking at sources of embryonic stem cells, what are there particular parameters about, you know, whether this needs to be from a healthy embryo, or how do you determine the seeds in an embryo? I mean, like, if it's used for, like, I know, you know, when you use the word tissue, I mean, one of the struggles is when there's a miscarriage, you know, a lot of times the hospital gives the parents the opportunity to decide, is this going to be determined as human tissue, or do you want to take the child home and consider it a child? It's a tough decision for a parent to make. But you know, in that tissue is, you know, then disposed of. But if it's the result of a miscarriage, I mean, does that affect sort of like what the stem
cells? You'd want to be awful careful there, yes. You'd want to check as much as you could about potential for health or disease. So yeah, that's part of the decisions that get made. And I've not been in a lab that was doing that work, so I don't know what all the precautions are there, or things that they check. So I'm just not sure.
But they are diseased sort of stem cells. I mean, stem cells aren't always just sort of pure.
I'm not sure if people have made lines from intentionally diseased embryos to study them, but that's within the realm of possibility as well. It is difficult to do research on human beings. There aren't a lot of us, you know, so it a lot of this work comes from work that is started with things like mice and study and study and study there, where we can get plenty of organisms. And in the old days, use them pretty much as we wanted. Now, there's been changes there in the last 20 years as well. Probably good changes.
So the mouse has been frequenting my room. Where could I do it?
Yeah, they seem to be very, very smart.
Maybe special.
It's all those carbohydrates from the bread here.
Well, are there any other questions or comments? We could wrap it up. I want to thank you for coming and talking, and I hope you keep talking about some of these things, and maybe do some reading on some of these things. So, thank you.